Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, Russia shocks many with its actions at the United Nations today. The big guns face questioning in the U.S. Congress on U.S. policy and ISIS. One expert's optimism about the Iran nuclear talks. And we meet a U.S. immigrant who gives back here and in her homeland.
I'm home wherever. It's where the heart is, and my heart is here right now.
Coming up on The Voice of America. The Russians have used their veto power at the United Nations to veto a measure on the massacre in Srebrenica, in which we are marking the 20th anniversary this month. Joining us on the line is VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir. Margaret, can you tell us what's happened?
Well, Susan, it was an interesting meeting this morning. The Russian ambassador called for a moment of silence among the council members to mark the horrors that happened at Srebrenica 20 years ago, and then he wielded his veto to strike down a motion that simply would have just called for reconciliation and talked about educating people to prevent genocide again in the future.
Now, this was a time when 8,000 Bosnian Muslim men and boys were systematically killed by the Serbian forces because of their religious faith. And you spoke very recently with the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Power, and she seemed optimistic that this would not happen.
She did last week, and today she said in the council that when she heard that Russia was going to plan to veto the resolution, she said, "No, I said no. Why would Russia vote to deny recognition of the Srebrenica genocide?" She was very dramatic about it. And she said today's vote mattered, and she said it mattered to the families of the victims of the genocide. And she called Russia's veto heartbreaking for those families, and she said it's a further stain on the Security Council's record.
Did other members react as well?
Yes, the British sponsored the resolution, so they were quite upset, and they said it was a very balanced text. They said there were victims on all sides. It did not name didn't accuse any party of the crimes. It just supported reconciliation, and it said that recognition of the past is a prerequisite of prevention in the future. So, you know, we must learn the lessons from the genocide. Interestingly, though, China abstained from the vote. They backed up their ally, Russia. They didn't veto, but they abstained. And Venezuela, Angola, and Nigeria also abstained. But the reason the measure failed was because of the no vote from Russia. It could have passed even with those abstentions had there been no veto.
What is your understanding of Russia's motive in doing this matter that has shocked a lot of people?
Well, Russia is very close to the Serbian government. They share an Orthodox religion, historical ties, and the Serbians were very upset about this resolution. They didn't want it, and they were very clear about that. And so they asked Russia, which is sort of their big brother, to stand up for them in the Security Council, and Russia did that.
I imagine they won't be waiting another 20 years before bringing something like this up again. But where does it go from here?
Well, I think really that's the end of it for now. I mean, it was meant to commemorate an event. It wasn't calling for any particular action. It's not like a situation that's ongoing currently. It's marking something in the past. But there will be other events. There was an event last week to mark to commemorate the genocide at Srebrenica. And, you know, look, the tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, the International Court of Justice, they have called it a genocide. They have ruled that it was a genocide. So in international fora, it is a genocide. And the Russians haven't denied that in other forums. So it was interesting that they were so worried about it here in the Security Council. But it's not going to change anything. The facts remain the facts. More than 8,000 Muslim men and boys died in Srebrenica.
Well, thank you very much for your time today, Margaret. I know it's very busy up there today.
Thank you, Susan.
My colleague Michael Lippin is here for a social media update on the Srebrenica genocide anniversary. Michael, as we just heard from Margaret about the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., what he had to say about Russia's veto, how did other members of the Security Council react?
Hi, Susan. Well, you know, I've been looking into that, and I did find some comments on Twitter from the British UN mission, whose handle is @UKUN_New York. It tweeted some more quotes from British Ambassador to the UN Peter Wilson, including these ones. Russia has chosen to side with those who, by their actions, are preventing reconciliation moving forward. We must act where we have early warning. We must find greater unity at the UN Security Council. And then the British mission added these hashtags, genocide and Srebrenica genocide 20 years. You know, that longer hashtag has actually been quite popular. The Topsy Analytics website shows that it's been used 13,000 times in the last day. Now, another UN Security Council member, New Zealand, also tweeted about the Russian veto using its handle at NZUN. It said, "It strikes us as particularly inappropriate that a veto was used at a commemorative event."
What other reaction than diplomatic has there been on Twitter?
Well, a lot of comments from users saying basically, shame on Russia. I have seen some pro-Russian tweets, though, being posted in English. One from user at Kika Bibic was critical of Bosnia, claiming that the country, where Muslims are the largest religious group, is a safe haven for Islamic State terrorists. Well, actually, authorities in Bosnia did arrest about 12 people recently on charges of fighting for the Islamic State group. But you know, there's been a noticeable lack of official comment from the Russian side. I checked the Twitter accounts of the Russian UN mission and those of some senior Russian officials, as well as Russian news agencies, and you know, none of them have talked about the Srebrenica veto so far. I did see one tweet from a Twitter user linking to an article earlier this month by our sister network RFERL. That article quoted Russian Deputy Ambassador Petr Ilyichev as saying the British-drafted UN resolution was divisive and focused too heavily on wrongdoings carried out by the Bosnian Serbs. Susan?
Well, thank you very much, Michael.
Thank you.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
NASA's New Horizons spacecraft, currently in the far reaches of the solar system, recently gave the space agency a bit of a scare. They say that the spacecraft experienced an anomaly on July 4th that led to a loss of communication between it and its controllers on Earth. The space agency says the problem has been resolved and that the New Horizons spacecraft has returned to normal science operations and is on target for its July 14th close flyby of Pluto. The glitch that forced the New Horizons to switch from its main to its backup computer was caused by a hard-to-detect timing error in the spacecraft's command sequence. But NASA says that the close brush with Pluto is on track and will proceed as originally planned. The New Horizons mission will allow us, for the first time, to get a close look at Pluto and its moons. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The Iran nuclear talks in Vienna continue. The deadline is Friday, July 10th. International Edition's Jeffrey Young just spoke to one analyst who is optimistic that we'll see a deal, and Jeff joins me here in the studio. Jeff, this is good news.
Yes, Susan, and that's the opinion of Mark Fitzpatrick at the International Institute for Strategic Studies in London.
I think there's a good chance of a deal being struck by the end of the week, but it's not at all certain. Having blown through two supposed deadlines already, there's now a precedent for further such extensions of the talks. Both sides are fighting for the best deal they can get regarding the remaining issues on the table, and they've decided that the deadlines are less important than getting the maximum advantage. So I wouldn't be surprised at all if the talks continue into next week.
Earlier this week, suddenly Iran said that they also wanted sanctions relief regarding their ballistic missile program and also their conventional arms program. They want to be able to buy arms in the world market. Now, does this throw a wrench in the works, or is this the sort of thing that one would expect at this stage in the negotiation as each side tries to maneuver for best advantage?
This is certainly to be expected. There aren't that many issues remaining to be decided. And as issues have been clarified and tentative agreements reached, new issues that haven't yet had the I's dotted and the T's crossed come to everyone's attention. In this case, it's nothing new what Iran is saying. All along, they've demanded that all UN sanctions be lifted. And all along, the United States and its partners have been saying, no, the nuclear sanctions will be lifted. But since we're not talking about missile developments in this arrangement, the prohibitions on missile sales will continue. and the sales on arms control would continue until Iran completely satisfies other elements of what is expected of it. You know, the United States and its partners aren't going to lift all sanctions in one fell swoop before Iran demonstrates its implementation of its obligations under the deal.
There's also the question of what has been termed snapback, the ability to reimpose sanctions if Iran is not following the regimen that is being set forth in this agreement. So the people understand what snapback is. Could you quickly explain that?
You know, snapback is one of these terms that might mean something different to different people, but it's pretty much, you know, the sound of the word. You snap your fingers, and immediately the sanctions that had been lifted get reimposed. Now, for some of the sanctions, that can be done almost immediately. For United States sanctions, you can bet your life that the very skeptical Congress will be ready to reimpose sanctions if Iran violates the deal. For United Nations sanctions, though, the snapback won't be so snappy. I think it would be some involved process of getting resolutions in place and so forth. But the objective of the United States and its allies is to get arrangements so that if Iran violates the deal, a return of the UN sanctions can't be held up by a future Russian or Chinese veto.
That was Mark Fitzpatrick at the International Institute for Strategic Studies in London.
Thank you, Jeff, for doing that research and stopping by.
Good to see you, Susan.
Coming up on International Edition, a face-off on Capitol Hill over the U.S. and ISIS. And we meet an immigrant chasing her American dream. Republican senators vented frustrations over U.S. efforts to fight Islamic State radicals and grilled Secretary of Defense Ash Carter and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff General Martin Dempsey at an Armed Services Committee hearing earlier this week. A joint paper by experts at Rice University's Baker Institute for Public Policy and the Center for the National Interest criticized U.S. policy in the fight against ISIS. International Edition's Mohammed El-Shenawy followed the Senate session and spoke with Joe Barnes, a co-author of that study, who warned against U.S. raising hopes about what it can achieve. Mohammed joins me now. Welcome, Mohammed.
Thank you.
What do you have to say?
Well, Joe Barnes argued that the United States needs to be realistic about what it can accomplish because without the introduction of substantial U.S. ground forces and retaking Sunni areas, it will be a long-term project. He blamed the president for raising unrealistic hopes.
When he declared the international effort against ISIL, President Obama talked about degrading and ultimately destroying it. In point of fact, for now, probably the best we're going to be able to do is contain ISIL. It's going to be a long and serious haul. And the president should be criticized, in fact, for raising expectations that the United States has no intention of meeting.
Barnes said when the United States raises hopes and then fails to deliver, it loses credibility even among partners and allies. Let's now move to the Senate Armed Forces Committee hearing, where the chairman of the committee, Republican Senator John McCain, described Obama's strategy against the Islamic State group as delusional. McCain told U.S. Secretary of Defense Ashton Carter, "There is no compelling reason to think anything the United States is doing will be enough to achieve Obama's goal of degrading and ultimately destroying the jihadist group." Senator McCain criticized also President Obama for ruling out ground combat forces.
The president is fond of the truism that there is no military solution to ISIL or any other problem. What he has so often failed to realize that there is sometimes a major military dimension to achieving a political solution.
Another Republican, Senator Jeff Sessions, said that because of the current day realities, President Obama is going to have to change his mind based on a campaign promise when reality is so different. Secretary Carter defended the president's policy while acknowledging that more needs to be done to strengthen the mission and to train local forces to combat the Islamist extremists. He said the strategy for defeating ISIL in Iraq and Syria is to support capable and motivated forces on the ground. However, Carter insisted that eventually the United States will deal the Islamic State group a lasting defeat, as he said, in Iraq and Syria through multiple lines of effort, from political and military efforts to providing humanitarian aid. U.S. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Martin Dempsey, told the committee he would not hesitate to recommend ground troops if and when the situation requires them. But so far, he said he hasn't made such a decision to recommend to the president.
Enduring stability cannot be imposed in the Middle East from the outside in. The fight is enabled by the coalition, but it must be owned by those regional stakeholders.
Some Republicans have long urged the deployment of U.S. special forces to help battle Islamic State fighters on the ground in Iraq. However, defense officials are reluctant to go that route for now.
Well, thank you very much, Mohammed, for that extensive report.
Thank you.
You're tuned to VOA.
Health news and notes. This is Living Better.
Researchers in the Netherlands find that eating a handful of nuts or peanuts every day is associated with a lower risk of death from several major disease categories. Professor Piet Vandenbrandt is with Maastricht University.
Nut intake seemed to be protective for both men and women. That was on total mortality, so any cause of death.
Health benefits of nuts have long been known, but Vandenbrandt says that just 10 grams a day is enough, about half a handful.
What we found is that the beneficial effect of nuts and peanuts is already apparent at a lot lower levels of intake than has been suggested before.
The researchers stressed that these benefits come from peanuts, but not peanut butter.
Did not show this effect at all.
Peanut butter contains added oils and sugars, which may nullify the peanut's health effects. I'm Martin Seacrest for VOA's Living Better.
My mother always told me it's not very polite to listen in on other people's conversations. But today we're going to be bad and eavesdrop on International Edition's Adam Phillips. He's been chatting with an immigrant who has made a new life in the United States. And Adam is eavesdropping right now to our conversation from New York and joins us on the line. Hi, Adam.
Hi. Hi, Susan.
Who are you speaking with?
Pakistan-born Dr. Asmaa Jameel Sadiq came to America nearly 30 years ago on a residency at Harlem Hospital, specializing in pediatrics. Since then, she's become the go-to expert for child development and stays incredibly busy working with the Cordoba Initiative, promoting interfaith and cross-cultural understanding. She also travels back home frequently to lecture on medicine, armed with all the great knowledge she has gained here. Dr. Sadiq began our conversation by telling me what moved her to practice pediatrics thousands of kilometers and a world away from her native Karachi.
I was very interested in self-esteem. I said I wanted to immunize children to feel good about themselves, and I worked in a program with mothers on crack and working with their children so they could get those children back, and it was called Reality House. And I found this work very enriching and humbling, because the kind of challenges people have to deal with and the heartbreak and where the resilience and strength comes from. And for myself doing this work, I just leaned deeper into my own spiritual essence or connections. I listened to a lot of Qawwali music.
Qawwali music?
It's a kind of spiritual music. It's Sufi in the sense that it is a spiritual practice. It's become very modern. It has its rock and roll, jazz, soul component to it with a lot of poetry, whether it's Persian, Punjabi, something I grew up with. So I wasn't doing it as a spiritual practice. It just connected me to my family and my roots. And I found it so healing because it is a spiritual message of divine love. Plus it's fun. It just made me very happy and high, and I wanted to share it with everybody.
Is there a connection between the diverse way and open-mindedness that you were raised with in Pakistan and the world of New York and America and all the diversity you found here?
New York very easily felt like home because of just the way New York is, the excitement of people around and the connectedness in so many ways. And I grew up like that in Karachi. I have a sister-in-law who's Christian. I have an aunt who's Jewish. My sister went off to India and married somebody who was half Muslim, half Hindu, as far as the parents were concerned. So there was a lot of openness in my particular family, and New York just has an energy, and I bloomed and blossomed here. Sure. I've had a lot of fun being here, but it's had its challenges as well.
Tell me about some of the challenges. That's very important to bring out, just as an immigrant.
There's a lot more connection growing up in the East. Here you have to build it. You can easily get very isolated. You're pretty much on a treadmill to find people who will love the kind of music I love or the food I love. That's what deeply nourishes me, finding that resonance.
How would you recommend immigrants who might be hearing this, or people who want to become immigrants, how would you recommend that they approach embracing it here but staying firmly rooted in their place of origin?
Well, you know, it's like being true to both, holding on to some of the stuff that you love, but also introducing it to the people you meet. Similarly, learning from others. You cannot just hold on to your roots and not grow where the sun is. You have to develop new branches and expand and connect. So, you know, it's like nourishing your roots, but be willing to grow towards the light.
So you had to come here to come home?
You know, that's true. I think I'm home wherever. It's where the heart is, and my heart is here right now. And it's also still in Pakistan and in India, and, you know, it's really anywhere where there's love and acceptance and joy.
Thanks so much for introducing us, Adam. We wish her continued success.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks so much, Susan.
We would like to invite you to join us on Twitter. You can find us at @VOA_IE. If you would like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner, then scroll on down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The use of new technologies is a key tool to promote human rights. Though authoritarian governments may seek to control the flow of information online, human rights activists, journalists, and everyday citizens can use technology to disseminate information, to expose corruption and other misdeeds and abuses, and to stay in contact with like-minded individuals. Last year, 41 countries passed or proposed laws or regulations to punish or restrict speech online. More and more governments increasingly blocked access to websites they deemed undesirable and criminalized online speech. In Tajikistan, for example, the government intermittently blocked access to social media sites, including Facebook and YouTube. The Turkish government briefly blocked YouTube and Twitter in the lead-up to local elections. In China, the government continues to block access to websites deemed controversial, such as those discussing Taiwan or the Dalai Lama or even the New York Times. And in December, the Chinese government blocked large numbers of users of Gmail, the world's largest email service provider. Other governments passed new laws to go after activists who use the internet to express themselves. Many who were arrested were sentenced to long prison terms, fines, corporal punishment, and even banishment. In Vietnam, authorities continue to harass, intimidate, arrest, and convict bloggers who express views critical of the government online. But even as governments attempt to control expression and access to information online, human rights activists use new technologies such as satellite imagery, video, and crowdsourcing technologies to gather and disseminate information and to document human rights abuses in areas where security and accessibility are a problem. Today, technology can be used to provide accurate information regarding protests, destruction, and violence in countries around the world. Technology can help increase transparency and fight corruption. So even as authoritarian governments become more aggressive in cracking down on freedom of expression, both online and offline, people in every country become more and more connected and better informed. Banning websites and blocking content are misguided attempts to impose order. Instead, governments must respect fundamental freedoms and promote an open global internet.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.